Hey, everybody. Yeah, hi. Yeah.
So what the Rav can tell us, what's the makor for that, and what's the idea behind it?
Yeah, I'm always asked to repeat the question. I sometimes don't do it, but I'll try to remember to do it. The question was that you see a minug that during the ninth month of pregnancy, when the wife is in her ninth month, so the husband will be honored with psicha, opening up the aron, as many weeks as it is. And the question is, what is the source for that? And second, what is the reason for that? So the truth of the matter is the source is a very late source. It's not, you're not going to find early Makoros. It's basically on Hasidus and Kabbalah. And it's based on the idea that Psichas Ha'arayin is always a way of getting, of invoking mercy from Shemayim. That's why we open the Oren at various times. And since every Yoledes is actually B'sakana, right? When a woman goes into childbirth, her actual life is in physical danger. That's why we're Mechalel Shabbos for a woman that goes into labor. And the baby, God forbid, can also be in Sakana. So Memela, as you approach the end of the labor, as you approach this man of the Leda, we want the husband to be able to get rachamei shemayim for his wife and for the child. So that became a minhag of opening up the Oren. For example, let me give you another example in a different context. You know, Ne'ilah, during the last tefillah of Yom Kippur, so the Oren HaKodesh is kept open for all of Chazaras HaShatz. Unlike the rest of Yomim Narayim, it's open, closed, open, closed, open, closed. Ne'ilah, it is open legamri, because that's the Zman of Rachamim, that's the final judgment. And in many shuls, they auction off the psicha for Ne'ilah for money, because to have the kavod of opening up the Oren for Ne'ilah is considered to be a segula, it's a positive characteristic for Rachamim, for that person. So people will spend a lot of money for that. So it's the same svara for psicha for Ne'ilah would be the psicha for Yoledes. Now, there are minhagim, maybe I shouldn't use the word minhagim, there are customs that are connected to childbirth that actually don't have a real makar, and they just became almost superstitious customs. For example, there is a custom that is practiced that a woman in her ninth month, even if she's not a nida, goes to the mikveh. Whatever that's considered to be a bracha or a skula, that in fact does not have a makar, and there's no real makam for that minog at all. Mm-hmm. But psichas arid is a different type of thing. Yeah.
In Yerushalayim, a lot of people are makbid to daven exactly toward the Beis Hamikdash, so even daven not in the direction of the Aron Kodesh. Now, in some other midrashim, people daven like literally 90 degrees,
yeah,
not in the direction. Is there a problem with that?
It is important to know that the halacha that we have to daven in the direction of the mikdash is a halacha in the Gemara itself, that is Medina de Gemara, and it is actually based on Psukim, where Shlomo HaMelech says, when he dedicated the first Beis HaMikdash, that the world will daven in that direction. So, Meikar Adin, we are mechuyev to daven, if you're not in Yerushalayim, in the kivun of Yerushalayim, and in Yerushalayim, in the kivun of the Harabayas, and actually technically the kivun of the Kodesh HaKdashim. Now that raises some interesting questions, because that doesn't mean east or doesn't mean west. It is whatever the direction would be. And yet there's a Gemara in Bava Basra that says, Haraitza Sheyachkim, if in your davening you're praying that Hashem should give you wisdom, you should face the south. And if you are praying that Hashem should give you parnasa or wealth, you should face the north. And the remez to that is because in the Beis HaMikdash, the shulchan with the lechem hapanim that represents parnasa was in the north, and the menorah, the light of which represents the Torah, was in the south. So you got a real contradiction there, meaning, am I supposed to daven facing Yerushalayim or facing the Mikdash? Or am I supposed to daven to the north or the south for Parnassah or for Chachma? All right, so there the Gemara explains that Avada, the dominant direction, should be towards the Beis HaMikdash, but then you incline to the north or to the south from that, whether it's dependent, whether it's Parnassah or whether it's Torah. But either way, the one thing that you don't see in the Gemara is any notion of facing the Aron HaKodesh. Meaning the only two choices we have is the dominant Iker is facing the Mikdash, and the secondary Iker is Daram or Tzafain, depending on north or south, depending on Parnassah or Chachma. Because I used to say that in my old shul in Silver Spring, because of the architecture, which was before I came, the Aron HaKodesh, or the Makom of Davening, was due north. We actually were facing north. So might be misplaced priorities, right? You know, you're only praying for Gashmis, but okay. So the truth of the matter is there is no per se halacha that you have to face the Aron HaKodesh. Now, it is true, generally speaking, we try not to have our back directly to the Aron HaKodesh. For example, an example is here. You see this in this very Beis Medrash, right? We daven this way, which is towards the Harabayas, and the Aron HaKodesh is in back of you there, right? So it's mamash thing. So al pi halacha, Makom HaMikdash is more important than facing the Aron HaKodesh. Yeah.
Where does the Haredi uniform of, you know, hat, jacket, etc., come from, and why is it of such importance to many people in yeshiva?
Yeah, so the question is, yeah, I think there's that mamash asked last week too. Haredi uniform, black and white, hats, etc., why is it so important? So really, I think you have to differentiate between hat, jacket versus black hat and black jacket. These are two different nekudas. The notion of hat and jacket were primarily the idea that for tefillah, for davening to Hashem, one should dress up a little bit the way they would go to a formal meeting. And that would mean, in other words, that you wore a jacket. And a hat also, even though it's not so common today, but, you know, 100 years ago or even 50 years ago, every gentleman, even a non-Jewish gentleman, if he'd go to an important meeting, would wear a hat. In fact, there is a legend. I grew up with this legend. I thought it was MS, but it turns out it's not really MS. That John F. Kennedy killed the hat industry in the United States. Because before John F. Kennedy in 1960, a gentleman wore a hat. Hat was a big thing. Everybody, look at pictures in the 1950s. You know, everyone wears a hat. But John F. Kennedy was a young guy, and he took the inaugural oath in the winter, January 1960 or 61. And he didn't wear a hat to show that, you know, he didn't have to cover up for the cold, wanted to be vigorous. Of course, he got assassinated 2 years later. But they say the whole hat industry got killed because Kennedy made it cool not to wear a hat. Lamaisa, that happens to be Sheker, based on the history of it, that's not MS. But so the hat and the jacket is a matter of dignity and kavod. Now, even then, that should only apply during davening. I mean, there's no logic to wear a hat when I'm going, you know, going out for pizza or whatever it will be. So the hat and the jacket, though, comes from kavod hatzfila. Now, the idea of black is relatively new. Indeed, if you look at pictures of Rav Steinman, you know, Gedolim, when they were Bachrim in Europe, you know, there were different colors. And in my own lifetime, when I was in Neri Yisrael in Yeshiva, we wore different colored shirts, different colored suits. I mean, again, I see pictures of myself from the 1970s. I cringe. I would never in a trillion years wear something that was common in Yeshiva at the time, like plaid and all sorts of different types of things. So what then happened was, what originally started as an inyan of kavod hatfila, honor for prayer, then became kind of a designated uniform to separate the people on the team versus the people not on our team, to kind of create a group solidarity, a group identity, just like Hasidim had the shtreimel and the long coat, the bekesha, although that was originally a Polish nobility garb, but it became identifiable. So, as I mentioned last week, there may be a certain amount of importance to kind of fostering group identity. We are a team, you know, that we're kind of working together, just like gangs have uniforms. But ultimately, one should not consider that to be ikr should be ikrim. I mean, far too often, we emphasize superficiality more than internality, panemius, and panemius is far more important. Okay? Yeah. I'm sorry, say again. Yehuda, you want to live in Yehuda and Shomron for a few months?
Oh,
if a person wants to live in Yehuda and Shomron, yeah? Is it halakhically permitted to live? Well, what is the problem? Because it's dangerous? What would be the, I mean, Yehuda and Shomron is part of Eretz Yisrael. And it's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, and it's a mitzvah for Jewish people to inhabit every part of Eretz Yisrael. So I'm not going to say it's Austria. The only question would be if it's a highly, highly dangerous area. So let's say I wanted to move to Ramallah. I wanted to move to Gaza. Maybe not, Taki, you could, but let's say in the middle, I want to move to Gaza. So it may be that, you know, you're not supposed to put yourself in a mamish, a place of sakana. But Yehuda v'Shomron generally, I would not call the West Bank generally as a makom sakana. There are a number of cities there, and, you know, Yidden live relatively normal lives.
Near our villages,
yeah, so I think it's fine. I think it's good. But you know, again, as I say, a person has to be sometimes concerned about sakana. Those are legitimate concerns. If somebody told me they wanted to move to Hebron, you know, I don't know if I would encourage it. Kiryat Arba is different, right? Kiryat Arba is the Jewish yeshuv right adjacent to Hebron. But Hebron proper is a hotbed of Arab violence and extremism. So I would not advise it. Although some Yidden have to move, some Yidden are in the middle of Hebron. They live. So you just have to use your shikol hadas as to how dangerous it is. But I wouldn't discourage all of Yehuda v'Shomron. There are many areas that a person can go in. Yeah.
I always wondered why the yeshivas put their focus so strongly on Gemara. Like, what makes it so special and important that we learn about it?
Yeah, it is a good question. The question is why do yeshivos put so much emphasis on Gemara, which crowds out almost everything else? In fact, it's interesting. Sometimes the girls' seminaries, the more modern ones, want to have the girls learn Gemara. And, you know, without getting into that particular issue, I would just say one answer that I would give is, you know, why are you trying to make the girls' seminaries like the boys' yeshivos? We ought to try to make the boys' yeshivos more like the girls' seminaries, because in the girls' seminary, Badafka, because they don't learn Gemara, they have Chumash, Be'iyun, and Hashkafa, and all sorts of halacha, all sorts of beautiful things that we're not able to incorporate because of Gemara, right? So in a sense, maybe it's better to, you know, make the yeshivas like the seminaries instead of the seminaries like the yeshivas. My wife tells me a story. I was in the U.S., so she was somewhere for Shabbos. So she mentioned there were some guys from Brisk over, and the whole discussion was that you guys don't know halacha. He says, no, you never learn halacha l'maisa. You only do Gemara, you only do lamdos. So the guy said, don't worry about it. When we get married, our wife will tell us, you know, our wife will tell us what to do on Shabbos and the like. So, you know, what you're raising is a good taina, but I think historically the idea of Gemara is not to tell you halacha, because you don't really know halacha from the Gemara. But Gemara is to understand the process, the way of thinking of Torah Shebal Peh. And the notion is that the work and the effort that you have to go through in order to understand the process, the Hava Amina, the Maskana, you know, the preliminary thought and the conclusion and the questions and the answers, open up your mind to connect yourself to Torah in a way that is said to be more powerful, at least for many people, maybe not for everybody. More powerful than other ways. Other types of learning, you might be absorbing information, but Gemara is refashioning your mind and refashioning your thoughts. And since when you connect to God's will, which is the oral law, you're connecting to God's essence, your Dveikus in Hashem is much, much stronger. And that's why we considered Gemara to be such an important limud. It's more of a metaphysical idea that by refashioning your mind and your brain to think about all of these concepts, you are connecting yourself to Hashem in very intense ways. And even if you're learning things that are not directly spiritual. Like, this is a very common problem people have. People, you know, people come to Or Sameach or any, you know, any yeshiva, if they're Chozrei B'tshuva, and they're coming to learn the meaning of life. The meaning of life. Open up the Talmud and you will see why God put you in this world. A big question that I've been asking, or you've been asking all of your life. So you come down, let's say you haven't learned Gemara before, you're coming down to your first Gemara Shir. Now I will know what life is all about. My guess is that a lot of people are going to be very confused. All of a sudden you're opening something up about two guys who are holding a talis, or a chicken laid an egg on Yom Tov. Are you allowed to eat the egg on Yom Tov? I mean, okay. Now, if you're analytical, you might find it interesting if you like analysis, but you're not going to find it directly life transformative. It doesn't really answer my quest for spirituality. And the short answer I'll give you, which is not a great immediate answer in the short term, it won't make sense in the short term, is you got to try it. Meaning to say, there is a process that is going on. Meaning, yes, the actual information, the actual data is not consciously going to change you in any way. But over time, as you're connecting to these patterns of thought, there are transformations that occur within you. And I can't explain why. The only explanation is, as the Nefesh HaChaim says, you're misdabek yourself, you're attaching yourself to God's will, and that becomes the ultimate source of transformation. So it does. In a way, it does not make sense. In fact, in many, many ways, you know, I mean, I both went to law school and I taught in law school. In many, many ways, a yeshiva is much closer to a law school than to a theological seminary. In other words, if you compare what we learn in yeshiva to what Lahavdil, a priest might learn in a seminary. In a seminary, the whole curriculum is about theological ideas. In a yeshiva, you're learning Nashim Nezikin, you're learning, you know, it's like law, you're learning law, legal stuff. And legal stuff, on some level, does not always appear to be spiritual. Now, Birchshon, we do have spiritual things too, you know, Derech Hashem, I mean, you know, there are things that we do that are spiritual, obviously. But those are kind of the side courses, right? That's not the main course. The main course is law school. You're taking law school courses. But because of the Kedusha, it does have a transformative effect on a person. Meaning, we're making the claim. Now, you might want to challenge me by conducting empirical experimentation on this. That the intense learning of Gemara should normally produce a better person. That's a pretty strong claim to make, and unfortunately, you could probably come up with a lot of exceptions where that's not the case. But as somebody once told me, it always makes you a better person. The guy that's a bad guy would have been worse without it. Okay, that's the terrence to everything, meaning as bad as somebody is, he would have been worse. Okay, I can't prove that one way or the other. But that's the claim. If you truly, truly immerse yourself, it does change you in positive ways. Yeah.
One question. I've heard this said, that all tragedy stems from us not having the base of Mikdash. Like, what's meant by that statement? And then even also, like follow on, like, even in the time of the base of Mikdash, there was plenty of tragedy. If you read through Josephus and you read through, just look in history also. And then, and people also make a further claim, like, about the base of Mikdash in the future, that, like, they're everyone's going to live blissfully, happily ever after, kind of like, so who's to say that won't also happen, like in the future, the same way that happened in the past?
Yeah, the question was about people say all tragedies are only because we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, and when we have the Beis HaMikdash, everything's going to be good. You know, many of you might know Rav Aaron Lapiansky, Shalita, the Rosh Hashiva in my old town of Silver Spring. He wrote a very excellent article in Mishpacha. He does a lot of writing. All of his writing is excellent. He wrote an article in Mishpacha magazine about the false yearning for Mashiach. Like, it's kind of like, when Mashiach comes, I won't need braces. Or when Mashiach comes, you know, it'll be great, you know, whatever. Number one, that's superficial. Mashiach is not there to straighten out my teeth. Okay, number one. But number two, it's not even true. Obviously, there were sorrows and there were tragedies when there was a Beis HaMikdash. among which was the fact that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed under Gullus and Chorban, and the Book of Malachim, where we had a Beis HaMikdash, a lot of bad stuff did happen. So if the statement is accurate at all, you have to put it this way. All tragedies happen because of our distance from Hashem. Now, when we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, that means by definition, we have a distance from Hashem. And when we have a Beis HaMikdash, we can also have a distance from Hashem, even if you have a Beis HaMikdash. Okay, which means if we establish a closeness to Hashem, then bad things don't happen because we're with a dovuk with our Kodesh Baruch. So maybe that's true. Now, the idea that when the next Beis HaMikdash comes, we will live lives without tzaras, there is a basis for that, but not because it's the Beis HaMikdash, but because it's the final Beis HaMikdash, meaning when Mashiach comes, it's going to be different than the first two times that we had a temple. Mashiach comes, the world comes, the whole world that survives after Gog and Magog will be a higher level of consciousness. There will be Makir Hashem. According to many statements in Chazal, there will not be a Yetzer Hara. And even if that is interpreted a little differently, it means the Yetzer Hara is not going to be as powerful as it is. So the world will be at a higher place. The world will be in a better place. If the world is in a better place, there'll be fewer tzaras. The Navi Yeshayo, the prophets tell us. Lo Yisa, in fact, the United Nations has this as their motto. Lo Yisa Goy El Goy Cherev. One nation shall not lift up a sword against the other nation. V'lo yilmadu od milchama. They will no longer learn war. So we have the promises of the Nevi'im that the final Beis HaMikdash will usher in a different type of world. But even then, the Rambam paskins that the world will be noyeg kimin hago in its normal way. You'll have to get a job. People will still die. Mashiach will die. Mashiach will die. And then be replaced by the son of Mashiach, a hereditary monarchy. The ultimate reward is Olam Haba or Techiyas HaMesim, but Yemosu Mashiach. You know, a lot of the, what you might call, smaller frustrations of life are still going to be there. Your air conditioner will work, may break down. You may have to get those braces. You know, those things are still going to be here even when Mashiach comes. But it's still going to be a different world, because we'll focus on those things, but the main focus will be on Torah, serving Hashem, a world of peace, a world of not only Avas Yisrael, but really Ava with the whole world. So those are divine promises. Those are the promises of the Nevi'im. But a lot of the minor frustrations are still going to be around.
Someone told me that the reason why Jews don't have dogs is because they have higher neshamas, and that they're the spirit of animals.
Yeah, well, that was said by someone who doesn't like dogs. Okay, So there are different things. If you're asking me, first of all, from the Gemara, it's muchrach, depending on our girsa, that people did have dogs, because the Gemara brings down. It's not, I don't remember if it's a Mishnah or it's a Brisa, but it's even from the Tanoim, that it's prohibited for a person to raise a vicious dog. An attack dog, because that could scare people, and God forbid, it could cause a woman to miscarry. Mashma, beferish, that having a dog is okay, right? So that's one thing. If you want to know the truth, why Jews, many religious Jews, don't have dogs, it goes back to more recent history, and that is in the Middle Ages and afterwards. Many Jews were subject to Polish nobility called the Poryts. They were like, the Poryts was the landowner who owned all the land, and the Jews were working for the Poryts. And the Poryts was often just very, very arbitrary, and he would have these attack dogs that would attack Jews, just as the Nazis did in the Holocaust. As a result, there became kind of a visceral fear of a dog, because dogs were associated with attack dogs, and dogs were associated with these anti-Semitic people, whether they're Nazis or the Polish noblemen, attacking Jews. So as a result, we got very scared, and the dog got regarded as something that's dangerous. And that's why Jews are afraid of, I mean, not everybody, but Jews are afraid of dogs. In fact, there's a whole course, I saw it in Israel, there's a course to help Haredi Jews get over their fear of dogs. It's kind of training them. It's a way of making a parnasa to help them get over that that fear. Now, I would also say too that you see from the Torah itself, and Chazal point this out, that dogs have a certain merit in Judaism. The Torah says we're not allowed to eat nevela, right? Nevela is an animal that wasn't shechted, a carcass. So what does the Torah say? La kelev tashlicha noso. You shall throw the nevela to the dogs. And Chazal say, have a drasha. Rashi brings the drasha, that because the dogs did not bark to scare the Jewish people as the firstborn were dying in Egypt, we give the dogs a reward that they eat the nevela. And Maral says, a beautiful thing, that the word for dog is kelev, right, kelev? And kelev is kalev, like the heart, because a dog is very attuned to the heart of the master. You know, I come from the Maryland, Washington, D.C. area, so one of the political things that are said in D.C. is that in Washington, if you want a friend, get yourself a dog, because there won't be any there won't be any human being that you can really really trust. Now it is true that among some Hasidim, Chabad in particular, they did develop a Kabbalistic association that dogs represent, or really all non-kosher animals represent, a lower level neshama of evil. And one should be merachik. In fact, Chabad, according to Chabad Minhagim, they don't want their kids to even have, artificial animals, that are not kosher, like a bear or a teddy bear or whatever it is, because they feel that these are represent tamei neshama. So there is, what you're saying, there is such a mahalach, but I don't think historically that was the aversion. I think our attitude towards dogs was fairly positive. And they do bring that they were some of the great Baalei Musar. The altar of Kelim's son had a dog, other people had dogs, and dogs can be very, very good for kids on all sorts of levels. I mean, there are kids who are autistic or just have difficulty relating to other people, and dogs can actually help them in a tremendously useful way. So I wouldn't make of it as some isra. I think the rayas seem to be the other way around.
In Makos, in the days, there's one of Mora Rosmali says Hashem made 365 negative commandments corresponding to the days of the solar calendar. So according to that view, like, why would Hashem make something according to a calendar which is, one, is not the one that Hashem gave us, and also one that's historically been idolatrous and pagan?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. This is the famous Gemara, Rav Simloy, at the end of Maseches Makos, that there are 613 commandments that we know, but then he subdivides them into 248 positive commandments, thou shalt do, and 365 negative commandments, thou shalt not do. And he says the 248, I'm just completing the quote, represent the bones. So each positive commandment gives life to a particular bone. In fact, there are later svarim that correlate mitzvos to which bone it is. And the 365, the Gemara gives two reasons. One reason is there are 365 sinews or ligaments. That's another reason. But the other reason is because of the 365 days of a solar year, that for every day you bring a mitzvah for that day. So the question is, we don't go with a solar calendar. The Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar. It's 12 lunar cycles around the earth, which is only around 354 days or 355 days and the like. So why should the mitzvos be correlated with the solar calendar? Now, I just want to say, though, your last point, I think I can answer fairly simple. And then you added, especially since that's a calendar that's based on Avodah Zarah. That last part is actually not true, meaning it is true that the names we give to the months, January, February, March, are Avodah Zarah. Yeah, that is true. And there's even the Shaila, are we allowed to use them? Our minhag is we do, but it's not so pashut. But the notion that the solar revolution, that's the earth revolving around the sun, takes 365 days. That is an astronomical, approximately, that is an astronomical fact. And that is actually very relevant in the Jewish calendar, because that is why we have leap years. Again, let me just remind you of the idea. I'm going to use approximate numbers. Solar year, that means the amount of time it takes for the Earth to go around the sun, 365. 12 lunar months, meaning the moon going around the Earth 30 days, is 354. So there's an 11-day difference. Again, I'm going approximate. An 11-day difference between the solar year and the lunar year. That means to say, without an adjustment, every year a Hebrew date is going to be 11 days earlier than the solar date. So let's say Rosh Hashanah, year one, let's pick a year, falls out September 1st. Next year it'll be like August 20th, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the problem is that would mean Pesach, the Torah says Pesach has to fall in the spring. But without an adjustment, a lunar calendar is going to move Pesach earlier, 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 until Pesach is going to be in the middle of the winter. Just like Ramadan. The Islamic calendar, our buddies across the street, the Islamic calendar is a pure lunar calendar with no solar adjustment. That's why sometimes Ramadan is in the summer, which is a very long fast day for them, and other times it's in the winter. Now, I understand why they don't want leap years. They want to keep Ramadan moving around so they can have short Ramadan fast days. Which means we actually do utilize the solar calendar in determining leap years, 7 out of 19 years, to push Nisan back into the spring. So it's not Avodah Zarah, it's an astronomical reality that's relevant to our calendar as well. But the question is, why was that given precedence over the lunar calendar in terms of the mitzvahs? That is a good question. It's not entirely clear why. The only thing I can think of is that a lunar year as a year is not an actual phenomenon of physical creation, meaning to say the lunar month is a natural thing. It takes 1 month for the moon to go around the Earth. A lunar year is nothing more than 12 lunar cycles, meaning there is nothing natural about a lunar year. Just like a week. A week, a day, is a natural thing. A week is not. A week is just 7 days. So a solar year is built into the Teva itself. So perhaps we want to link the mitzvos, since God looked into the Torah and created the world, we want to link the mitzvos to a natural cycle in the world. And the natural cycle of the world is the solar year, not the lunar year. Ah, you'll ask me, so if a solar year is the natural cycle of the world, why were Jews given the commandment to use a lunar year? The answer is because Jews are above the natural cycle of the world. That's exactly it. That Badafka, we measure time not through the natural cycle, but by a multiple of lunar cycles. Okay? But it's a good question. Yeah?
What exactly does
Yeah, what does Av HaShoah look like for people who are actively spreading Sheker? Yeah, it's a hard situation. I mean, theoretically, what could exist, you don't see it that much, is that you can express that you care for people and you wish them well and you bless them and you want to be makariv them and you want to help them in every way you can, but you still have to fight certain ideas that are against Hashem, meaning Avas Yisrael does not mean accepting or compromising ideas that are against God's Torah. So you have to separate, so to speak, the idea from the person. Just like Broria told Rabbi Meir, based on the drasha of Itamu Chatoyim, you hate the sin, but do not hate the sinner. Now, Lemaisa, it is a much more complicated issue than that, because Lemaisa, you can find many, many makoros that actually say you should hate the people that hate God. David HaMelech says, Misanecha Hashem Esna, I hate those who hate you, meaning hate Hashem. Now that doesn't just say I hate their ideas. I hate them because they hate God and they hate Torah, and therefore they hate the Jewish people. So on some level, if you want to, you could certainly find Makoros that talk about hating Rishayim. But, I take as my guiding light the words of the Chazon Ish, where the Chazon Ish writes, and the Chazon Ish was not a modern Orthodox rabbi, who said we got to get along with everybody. The Chazon Ish was the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish says that the concepts of Rishayim, of evildoers, only applied when there was no divine concealment, meaning most of the Jews were keeping the Torah, we had a Beis HaMikdash, etc. So then, if you rejected the Torah, you were doing so out of an evil heart. Today, people are all like Tinok Shenishba. I mean, they weren't raised that way. So the categories of Rishoyim don't apply. The ideas can still be wrong, and the ideas can still be very, very bad, and you have to fight the ideas. But it doesn't have to degenerate into a personal vendetta against somebody. Now, the good news with that is that that is exactly the best way you can help them change their ideas as well. Meaning, if somebody is preaching ideas, they're against the Torah. And I'm sitting there yelling, Apikores, Kofer, Amalek, Erev Rav, all of the different epithets that we like to use in Eretz Yisrael so generously. So how does a person respond? How does a person respond when they're called Apikores, Amalek, Erev Rav, evil? They're just going to get more determined to fight you. Oh, I'm an Erev Rav? Well, you're a parasite. Which is worse? Masha Ein Kain, if you treat them with respect, that softens them up, and then they're open very much to what you want to teach. Do you remember, this is before October 7th, so long ago, people don't remember this. Before October 7th, there was a crazy thing that was tearing apart the country. We always have some crisis here. And the crisis before October 7th was a crazy thing involving judicial reform. It's so arcane. Netanyahu wanted to change the power of the Israeli Supreme Court, which is very powerful, and he wanted the Knesset to have more control. Now, for 70 years, the liberals were fully in favor with that because the Knesset was controlled by liberals. But now that there's much more religious influence, all of a sudden they become supporters of the Supreme Court. So Netanyahu's desire for judicial reform was turned into a religious secular confrontation, although it didn't have to be. So Haredim, who are not even involved in this fight, were attacked as they're trying to undermine the Supreme Court, etc., the rule of law, whatever it would be. So there were Chiloni demonstrations in Bnei Brak against people who probably didn't even hear of the Israeli Supreme Court, but you're trying to destroy our court system, whatever it would be. Now, to the very, very great credit, and I was a little surprised, of the Bnei Brak Kehila, they did not respond with invective, they did not respond with name-calling, they did not respond with any type of counter-demonstration, which is a chiddush, so to speak. But it was Erev Shabbos, and they brought out kugel, they brought out cholent to the people who were demonstrating against them. And then they started playing music. They started playing Shalom Aleichem, the old Nigun Shalom Aleichem, right? The old Shalom Aleichem Nigun. And there's a picture, it's really a classic picture, of this guy, this old guy, he's like 70 years old, old liberal, he's wearing an Israeli flag and he's moving around his fist, against the Haredim. And when he hears these Shalom Aleichem on the loudspeaker, tears are running down his face. Tears are running down his face. Because he remembers when he was a kid, like 70 years ago, he heard this song every Friday night, and it reminded him of Shabbos, and it reminded him of Kedusha. It reminded him of Torah. And he took off, he took off his demonstration clothes, whatever it would be, and he said, we have to have Shalom. So this is what Avos Yisrael can look like. This is a long answer to your question. But the idea is, don't condemn people. People make all sorts of mistakes. Listen, we make mistakes too, right? we're not perfect. We make a lot of mistakes. And try to show people that they matter, that they care, that they're beloved in Hashem's eyes. And you'll find that often they'll be much more open to whatever message it is that you want to send. This thing about fighting just creates more fighting. You attack, then you're going to be attacked. And then you'll attack more, and then you're going to be attacked more. And it's going to keep on going and going and going and going. And nothing ever gets resolved. Everything gets worse. And this is, I've quoted this pasuk a million times, but it's Shlomo HaMelech's pasuk in Shir HaShirim. Kamayim apanim alpanim, kein leva adam li adam. As water reflects the face, you show it. So too the heart of one person reflects what you show it. I look into a pool of water. Whatever face I show the water is what I get. I smile at the water, I see a smile. I frown at the water, I see a frown. Leiv adam li adam, the same thing. I show you covered in derech eretz, you will feel covered in derech eretz to me. I show you disdain, I show you disparagement, that is what you will feel towards me. So we need to think about that in terms of how we connect to different types of Jews. Yeah. Yeah, in the back here, yeah.
Isn't truth the idea that when Mashiach comes, you won't have to work
like to make a living? I didn't hear. Say again.
Is there any truth the idea that when Mashiach comes, the rest of another time, that people won't have to work to make a living? Like, is there any idea that if, like, what would be the struggle that they would have to deal with in this world?
Right. So the question is there any truth to the statement that when Mashiach comes, we're not going to have to make a living? So this goes back to the braces question, right? Mashiach comes, I'm not going to need braces. Mashiach comes, I'm not going to need a job. I remember this. You know, I remember, when Obama was running for president all the way back. So I remember this. Some woman was injured. She said, I'm not going to have to pay my mortgage. I'm not going to pay my taxes. What did she think? She says, I'm not going to pay taxes. It'll be great. Like, you know, Obama was Mashiach, whatever it would be. So again, the truth is there are machloksim, but if I just go with the psak of the Rambam, in Hilchos Melachim lays down a rule, Olam k'minhago noheg. That means the world, in terms of the gashmias of the world, is going to continue the way it is. Yeah, there won't be war, there'll be peace, there'll be wonderful, wonderful things. Kedusha, Beis HaMikdash, Nevuah. But in terms of Parnasa, in terms of those details, you still have to do it. Now, the only thing the Rambam does say is, that b'derech hateva, not supernaturally, b'derech hateva, Hashem will make the parnasa available, so there won't be unemployment. In other words, there'll be jobs for people, and people will get paid, which is right. Those are two different things. You can have a job and not get paid. So the parnasa will be berevach. The Rambam does say that. But you're still going to have to work. You're still going to have to find a job. You still have to undergo the hishtadlus. Again, the Rambam shita is olam k'minhag einayad. Now, lamaisa, and the Rambam brings psukim that go the other way around, because some psukim say the famous pasuk v'gor ze'ev imkeves, the wolf will lie down with the lamb. That seems to be supernatural. The Rambam says that's a mashal, that the strong nations will not wage war against the weaker nations. Now, I have to say that the Ravitz and other Rishonim do have a much more miraculous view of Yemos HaMashiach, so there it's Shayach that those changes will happen. Now, the other question that you can raise, though, is, okay, that's Yemos HaMashiach, but what's going to happen when there's Techiyas HaMesim, which is an extra stage? So that might be different. That might be a supernatural world akin to Olam Haba. So maybe at that point, yeah. Say again?
When the next stage, why would it have to be?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Essentially, what Techiyas HaMesim is, at least according to Ramban, is it brings the guf into Olam Haba. Meaning, Olam Haba alone is only neshama. Techiyas HaMesim is the hashlama of the guf being in the neshama. Now, that's only like Ramban and Derech Hashem. Lemaisa, according to the Rambam, I would actually suggest Techiyas HaMesim is not going to change anything, because the Rambam has an unusual shita that's not even taught in yeshivas, as far as I know, that Techiyas HaMesim is only temporary. The Mesim come back, and they're going to die. It means, according to the Rambam, the only permanent thing is Olam Haba. So if Techiyas HaMesim is only a temporary phenomenon, I don't think anything is going to change. They're going to have to work too, the people who come back. But like Ramban and the Mekubalim, and this is the mainstream understanding, that Tchias HaMesim is the end stage, which will be forever and ever and ever. Tchias HaMesim is essentially Olam Haba augmented by the Guf. So I don't think at that point there'll be any need to work at that point. Yeah.
This is a question that was sent in. Someone asked, what is the halakha regarding Jews living on government assistance? For example, food stamps, Medicaid, receiving help with heating and and is it okay to temporarily rely on the government for assistance, or is it better to rely on one's own community in times of need?
Yeah, so the question is, what is the halakhic perspective on getting government assistance, and is it, if there is a need, is it better to get assistance or rely on family or community and the like? It is a good question. On one hand, Chazal are normally against people taking tzedakah unless they have to. The Lashon of the Gemara is, Peshot Nevela Bashuka. Even if your job is a very despicable job, you're skinning carcasses in the street, roadkill or whatever it would be, better to do that than to get tzedakah. One should try to avoid being mekabel tzedakah. On the other hand, it is also clear that there's no iser per se. If a person cannot support themselves any other way, then of course they should take tzedakah. So the interesting question is, okay, so if I really need to take tzedakah or charitable funds or public welfare funds, I'm allowed to do it. But what if I'm doing it not because I have to do it, but because this is the way I can remain in kollel and learn? Meaning I do have the alternative of getting a job and making a living, but I want to learn. That's a much more difficult question. Meaning it's easy enough to say, if you have to take tzedakah, then take it. If you don't have to take tzedakah, then don't take it. Okay, got it. Well, if I'm taking tzedakah because I'm learning, does that mean I have to take tzedakah? Or I could make the choice? So that is a difficult question. If you read the Rambam very literally, the Rambam would actually say, go to work and don't sit and learn and get stuck of money and the like. On the other hand, most, as you know, most obviously disagree with that. And they say that, listen, if this is a system that either makes tzedakah available for these purposes, or in the case of public welfare, the government makes it available, as long as you're not cheating, as long as you're not lying, and by the way, I want to double underline that, we are not talking about lying, cheating, understating income. We're talking about honesty. But as long as you're honest and open, if the government doesn't want to support kollel people, let the government pass a law not to support kollel people. And then we'll have a demonstration over it, or whatever it is. But as long as legally you are eligible for that aid, and you're not lying, then many would argue, why shouldn't you be allowed to take it? As I say, I think the Rambam might argue with that, but that would be our position. There is nothing unethical, immoral, or against halacha in taking either tzedakah money or public welfare money, as long as you're getting it in an honest way and under the legal regulations, you are entitled to get it. So I would say it is okay, you know. But as I say, if you look in the Rambam, and the Rambam apparently felt so strongly about this that he writes it in several different places, in the Mishneh Torah, in Pirkei Avos, in Shmoneh Perakim, which is the Hakdamah to Pirkei Avos, the Rambam was absolutely against getting any type of communal money for the study of Torah. The Rambam was frankly anti-kollel. I think it's very, very clear. He was anti the notion of kollel except for family support. He said, if your family is supporting you, that's fine, but you don't expect the tzibor to support you. So the Rambam would not be in favor of kollel, but already by the Kesef Mishnah's time already, they say, oh, we don't pass like the Rambam. No. Of course, this is the famous example, because the Rambam gives the example of the ideal person. We call him the Rambam's Balabayas. He says, a person should have a parnasa. One should not get paid for learning Torah. You have a parnasa. You work 3 hours a day, and then you have 9 hours of daylight time to learn. So many people have argued, okay, give me a job like that. And I won't take kolo money. But in the modern economy, more or less, there are no such jobs like that. So Mimela, you know, the conditions of the Rambam, I don't know if they existed in his time either. I mean, the Rambam himself didn't work only 3 hours a day. The Rambam writes that he spent the whole day. He was the physician of the caliph, of the reigning authority in Egypt. And he was treating hundreds of patients a day, the whole palace. And the Rambam says he would come home, he would leave early in the morning and he would come home several hours into the night. And he was busy the whole day and he hadn't eaten anything. And when he got home, there was a line of people waiting. Some wanted to have medical treatment. Some had shilas, etc. And the Rambam said he needed 10 minutes to eat something. And you know, and he wrote the Mishnah Torah like after midnight. That's when he wrote the Mishnah Torah. So the Rambam himself didn't live up to his ideal schedule, but this was his ideal schedule. So, you know, in fact, someone would argue that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created these welfare systems so that Torah should be supported. That's why they came into existence in the first place. But again, I want to repeat myself. We are talking about honestly claiming the money. We are not talking about lying. Okay, lying would not be proper, even though you think it's for a good cause. People make the big toys that, hey, better for me to get the money than some, you know, guy that, or some, you know, who's doing drugs or whatever. Yeah, that's not a cheshbon, meaning you're not allowed to lie, even though you're getting the money for a good and noble cause. Okay, we're talking about emes. Yeah. Yes. I'm sorry, I'm just having difficulty hearing. Could you repeat the question again? I'm sorry.
I was basically asking about explaining Yerida Sederis.
Yerida Sederis, right. Yeah.
So does it affect Goyim as well?
Ah, okay.
In terms of intellect as well as character.
Yeah, so let's take it one at a time. I know you had a few questions. So the first question is, we have this principle called Yerida Sederis. The generations get inferior with the passage of time. And that's why, you know, we don't argue with the Vilna Gaon or we don't argue with the Gemara, because there's a Yerida Sederis. So the question is, does that apply to the non-Jewish world, either in terms of intellectual achievement or in terms of character and midos? Is there inevitably going to be a degeneration and the like? So I think the answer would be not necessarily so, because part of why we have Yerida Sederis is that Klal Yisrael reached the highest epitome of Kedusha at Maimed Har Sinai. So the further we are from Har Sinai, the less connected we are to that Gilei Shechina, and that's why we're degenerating. The Umos Olam did not participate in Matan Torah itself, so you're not going to have that Yerida Sederis. On the other hand, you have to understand something. When we say Yerida Sederis, even for Jews, in areas of science and technology, when it's not Ruchnius, we don't have Yerida Sederis. We seem to be accomplishing more. Although, even there, we're building on the foundations. We're building on the foundations. You know, the fact that, you know, we have a car and 500 years ago they didn't have a car, that doesn't mean necessarily we're smarter or whatever. We're like midgets standing on the shoulders of giants, can see further than the giant. That's a famous mashal that the Rishayim give. But in terms of Goyim per se, I don't think you'll necessarily have a Yerida Sederis, but sometimes you will, meaning you have to look but for a different reason. In other words, I would suggest that the Yerida Sederis that may exist in the world is not because of the Merchak from Har Sinai, but it's precisely because as Gashmias becomes more and more and more plentiful in the world, it affects a person's character and discipline and ability to work hard for things. Which is a different lumbus, it's a different cheshbon. But Lamais, I think that's why there is a Yerida. There is a Yerida in the Deris. People don't know how to work for things. People don't have the discipline to stick with things. I think we see this in the world that we live in, even among the non-Jewish world. But it is a different cheshbon, it's a different dynamic. Yeah?
So, when it comes to, I've heard there's a difference between hashkafa palet and hashkafa pratet when it's related to Jews and non-Jews. If non-Jews are subject to general divine providence, but not specific divine providence. So I'm wondering if that ends up actually having an effect to where their lives are subject to some greater sense of randomness, less crazy bump-ins to their friend at the perfect moment. And also related to that is, the Gid Gemonitos being something that only applies between Hashem and Klal Yisrael, does that mean that Goyim are more subject to suffering in this world and they're more subject to Midas Adin?
Yeah, yeah. So this is a bit of a complicated question simply because it brings in complicated ideas, and that is the idea of hashgacha. Hashgacha is divine providence, the divine supervision of life. And we have what is called hashgacha pratis, which means God is looking at me individually and Hashem is determining the course of my life, what will happen to me. Where will I be at a certain time and place? What will happen to me in that time or place? God is directing it specifically. That's called Hashgacha Pratis. And by the way, I just want to point out, people often use Hashgacha Pratis to mean that God will protect me. Not necessarily. I mean, God may decree that you be in the World Trade Center September 11th. In other words, it just means Hashem is making the decision. Hashgacha Klalis is general Hashgacha, and that simply means, well, Hashem determines, you know, if there'll be 200 million people in the U.S. or 300 million people in the U.S., but he allows nature to operate until it reaches the boundaries of what Hashem's parameters are, and then he'll turn it off or divert it. But Hashem is not, does not care, so to speak, if this person dies or that person dies. He simply has certain goals. And when those goals are met, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu will allow nature to operate. So a common idea is that Jewish people get the benefit of Hashgacha Pratis, the benefit or the burden of Hashgacha Pratis, but Lagabe non-Jews and the like, there's Hashgacha Klalis. Hashem will determine if the United States will have a nuclear war or not a nuclear war, etc., but whether somebody dies when a building explodes. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says he leaves it to the natural order of things. So the truth of the matter is, whether that's entirely true is not at all pashut. The Rambam seems to imply that even for Jews, there is not always a Hashgacha Pratis unless the person is righteous or it's tzaddik. That sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu leaves a person to the forces of nature. Meaning if a person dies, Chas V'Shalom, it's not because God decreed that he would die, but simply HaKadosh Baruch Hu lets nature take its course. On the other hand, some people in Hasidus and in Kabbalah and the Derech Hashem, which is based on Kabbalah, says 100% that every single Jew, every single time, there is Hashgacha Pratis. So you have to analyze this in terms of Rambam versus Derech Hashem. Now, the other way around, let me point out, that even if, let's say, non-Jews have Hashgacha Klalis, which means they could be subject to the forces of nature without a specific divine decision, it would appear that through the kayach of tefillah, they could call on God to protect them as well, meaning goyim can daven as well. In other words, the whole shaila of hashgacha klalis, hashgacha pratis, is what you would call the default setting. What is the normal operation of things? But the normal operation of things can always be changed by specific and limited divine interventions. So let's take the Rambam. The Rambam says, even Jews don't have Hashgacha Pratis. We're left to the forces of nature. Well, if that's what he means, then what's the point of davening? The answer is pashut. The default setting is, I could be subject to the teva, but through the kayach of tefillah, Kadosh Baruch Hu can intervene. So it's important not to make this a more universal thing than it is. Even Hashgacha Klalis can have specific divine interventions of Shemira, and even Hashgacha Pratis can sometimes have an onesh of siluk hashgacha. That's good for the hashgacha. The hashgacha for you is I am misalik my hashgacha, leaving you to mikrei ateva. Okay, so the only question is, what is the norm? But the norm can be readjusted at any moment, either from pratis to klalis, or from klalis to pratis, both for a Jew and for a goy. But nevertheless, to answer your question directly, it is true that the Derech Hashem and all the Mekubalim say that the norm for a Yid is Hashgacha Pratis. The norm for a guy might be a Hashgacha, more of a Hashgacha Kolalis. That's very true. Yeah?
I'm pretty sure it says in Kedushin, Lamed Beis, that if Hashem didn't hate a person and fight the Yitzhar Hara, we would be unwilling, to withstand against it. What does this mean exactly, and in what manner does Hashem aid someone in fighting the Yitzhar?
Yeah, so this is the well-known statement in Chazal, that Yitzray, I'll give you the whole quote, Yitzray shel adam misgaber ala b'chol yom. The Yetzer Hara in a person gets stronger and stronger every day, gets stronger. Il malei HaKadosh Baruch Hu ozro. If Hashem would not help him, lo yuchal loy, he would not be able to be victorious over the Yetzer Hara, right? So this is the well-known teaching of Chazal, that without divine assistance, the Yetzer Hara will overpower me every single time. I mean, the short answer is, listen, I mean, the divine assistance doesn't mean, you know, God sends down, you know, an army or an angel. It refers to you, when you make the decision to do the right thing, it's Hashem giving you the strength to make that decision. Meaning, on your own, we would be too weak. On our own, we would always be defeated. But what HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees is, he sees what our inner desire is. And once he sees this is what we want to do, he then gives us the strength to carry it out. So it's really a partnership here. We supply the desire, and then Hashem supplies the ability. Okay, so it's a very seamless process. You're not going to necessarily have a sense that Hashem is giving me a power at that given moment. But that's really how it works. He is giving you the power to carry out your will. And this dovetails with another Maimer Chazal, V'derech she'adam reitzei leilech, the pathway that a person wants to go, molichan oso, that's where Hashem will take him. Hashem will take you where you want to go. And that means he will give you the koach to fight that Yetzer Hara. But that's conditioned on you having that desire. Which means, in a sense, when we do fail, and all of us fail, it's because, I don't want to make anyone feel guilty, I mean, the Musar is directed to me too, it always means, almost always, I don't want to say always, that our desire wasn't strong enough at that moment. For whatever reason, I mean, it happens. Because if we have the desire, Hashem will give us the strength. Memela, if I didn't have the strength, I didn't have enough of a desire at that particular moment. Yeah.
How should we relate to blaming specific tragedies, phenomena, such as the Holocaust? And how do we think or know that this is why Hashem did this?
Yeah, so the question is, sometimes great people, Gedolim, might attribute a reason to a tragedy, maybe even the Holocaust, or more recently October 7, and they say, it's because of this. And the question is, how do we relate to it? There are actually a number of ways of asking the question. Do I have to accept it? Do I have to believe it? Do I respect the Gadol who made that statement? How do I deal with it? So first of all, we have to remember the obvious. We don't have Nevi'im today. We do not have Nevi'im. There is no Nevuah. There has been no Nevuah since the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. A Navi gets a direct message from Hashem. Right, so Yirmiyahu HaNavi could say, the Chorban is because of this. Who told you? Hashem told me. Okay, right, so that's a pretty good source of information. But when you don't have Nevi'im, so by definition, you don't have a clear and definite answer. Now, the Gemara in Bava Basra says, however, that even though Nevuah was taken from the Nevi'im, Chachma was not taken from the Chachamim. The Gemara in the first paragraph of Bava Basra, Chacham Adif Minavi. And a Chacham can sometimes even be greater than a Navi. So we do believe on one level that the Chachma Satayra can give a Gadol an insight into why things happen. And that is why Chazal, right? Chazal give reasons for tragedies all the time. Chazal say the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. Okay, maybe that's based on the Nevi'im. But they say the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sin HaSchinam. There were no Nevi'im by the second Beis HaMikdash. Elamai, Chazal say it. And Chazal, but the thing about Chazal that's interesting is this. Chazal never give a single reason. Even the famous Gemara, Sin HaSchinam, but there's other Gemaras that say Shmira Shabbos, Bittul Torah. So Chazal give a whole bunch of reasons, even though you may find in any given Gemara only one reason. So I would suggest that Chazal themselves understood that we can identify the pegamim that we have to be misakin. And that's the chiyuv of a gadol, to be madrich in this way. But we can never give something as the one and only cause. Chazal always give more than one reason for things. Each one focuses on what they consider a tikkun. So the only way I think you could reasonably understand what Gedolim are trying to communicate is they're not giving you the reason, but they're saying this is something we have to look at and this is something we have to be misake. Is it the only thing? No, but let's focus on this for now, and other times we'll focus on other things. Okay, so I wouldn't look at it as the reason. There's no way that they can know that that is the reason. Yeah.
The Mishnah says, I think, to Rabbi Yochanan, that no one ever said shalom to him first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that something that we should do nowadays? Because
yeah, you know, it is. You know, it is so weird that you're not allowed to be friendly. If you're friendly to people, you know, you look like you're a nut. One of my rebbeim once said his first day in Lake. I mean, he's a very, very chashuv of a person. So, his first day in Lake was probably 1955, really a long time ago. But he said, he went after Shacharis, and he said Shalom Aleichem to somebody after davening, and the person said, that's not the minog here. Yeah. You know? So, okay, that's what it is, you know. Now the Maisa, Rav Chaim Eiser once said, somebody once asked Rav Chaim Eiser, who was in Vilna, about this Gemara, that Rav Yochanan greeted everybody, even the Goyim, Nachri Bashuk, he was always the first one to say, good morning, how are you? So how come we don't do that? So Rav Chaim Eiser said, when he was the Rav of a small town, Itaka did it. But he's in Vilna, so what's he supposed to do? I mean, there are hundreds, thousands of people. You know, he's walking by every day. What's he supposed to do? Hello, 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 hello. So Rav Chaim Eiser said, you have to look at it practically. In a big, bustling city with a lot of people, it's not really shayach to do. But even Rav Chaim Eiser said that in a small, like, local environment, it is very, very proper to do. So, I mean, listen, I mean, I'm going to plead guilty. I'm not zoher in it either. But lemaisa, I think it would be a nice midah to cultivate. It's not brought down as a halacha. Remember, not everything in the Gemara is stated as a halacha. It is stated as a unique midah of Rabbi Yochanan, mashma, that not everybody was, not even all the Amoraim were doing it. It was a hanhaga taiva of Rabbi Yochanan. But Chazal use it as a midah taiva that one should try to emulate. So I think it is a nice thing to. Of course, with men, women thing, I mean, I assume, you know, who knows? I assume Rav Yochanan didn't greet women that way, but you know, who knows? But at least man to man would be a nice thing. Yeah, in the back. Yeah.
Sometimes that we meet with the Horas Shah, or sometimes we have to. We have like a And also we have sometimes that I could be mekayim the Torah, but still I could be missing in the spirit of things and stuff like that.
So missing a?
Missing in the spirit of things.
Yeah.
Or I could still be a bad person. So why couldn't Hashem just make the Torah in a better way, that if I'm following the Torah, then I'll be a good person?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, interesting question. On one hand, we have a Torah, and we have a halachic system, all sorts of rules. But then we have counter rules, in which sometimes you don't follow this, let's go outside of this. And you mentioned a few examples. Eis lasos l'shem, in order to preserve the Torah, we violate the Torah, such as writing down the oral law. Or sometimes we say, go beyond the law, keep the spirit of the law, and not only the letter of the law. So the question is, if we're going to have these deviations from the system, one would think that that kind of represents an imperfection within the structure. So why couldn't Hashem, kavyochol, make the Torah more perfect so we have everything in there, instead of saying we have it this way, but sometimes you got to go outside of it? It's a very excellent question. I would give you two answers. One is a pragmatic answer, and one is a theological answer. The pragmatic answer is that it's not shayach for the Torah to encompass every type of situation a human being is going to face. By that I mean to say, this is the Magid Mishnah says such a svara. There has to be a lot of things that are left to be figured out outside of the system, because otherwise the Torah would be, including Gemara, including the Torah Shebaal Peh, would be 20, 100, a million times larger than it is. So as a result, he gave us a structure, and there's a lot of things we still have to figure out. In other words, that's pragmatic, meaning it's not shayach to encompass every type of contingency, every type of case that could ever exist. The more theoretical, theological idea is HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted Klal Yisrael to be partners in creating Torah as well, meaning he gave us a structure and he wanted us to have a certain achrayas in figuring things out. He didn't want to give us the Torah on a silver platter. He didn't want to give it to us in a pre-digested way. In fact, that's the whole structure of Torah Shebaal Peh: question, answer, havamina, maskana, machlokas, confusion. He wants us to be his shutvim in Torah. And that's why he created what you might call, not really, an incomplete Torah that needs all of these supplementations, because this way we become the bialim with Hashem over the Torah. In fact, this is the Ksais says that this is the meaning of the Gemara in Brachos. It's a famous Gemara. Ki lekach toiv nasati lechem. Hashem says to us, I gave you a good purchase. So the Gemara in Brachos says that the midah of Hashem is not like the midah of a basar v'dam. When a basar v'dam sells a precious heirloom, because he needs the money, the mocher is unhappy, and the lokeach is happy. But Hashem sells us the Torah, he's happy with us as well. So the kasha is obvious. I mean, when I sell you an heirloom, I've given it up. Hashem didn't give up the Torah. Why are you comparing it to Hashem selling us the Torah? So says the Ketzais, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu left the Torah to the interpretation of the Chachamim, and therefore, in a sense, Hashem abdicated a certain control over the Torah so we could be mashlim the Torah. So yeah, so the Dimyon to Mechira is a very good, that's Lo B'Shamayim, the Torah is not in heaven, etc. It's all connected to that, you say. Yeah. Yeah.
And I heard, I'm not sure if it's Rabbanim or politicians, say that one of the reasons not to implement it would be because if God forbid at some point I say that Jewish person potentially or unintentionally, you know, kill somebody, then that would, you know, be dangerous in that regard. So I want to understand what the Torah approach is to, you know, giving capital punishment to terrorists, and is that
Yeah, so the issue is the controversy in the Knesset about capital punishment for terrorists. I'm not sure why there's a great controversy. You mentioned one particular reason. So let's just analyze it halakhically. If we assume initially, at least, that the terrorists are not Jewish, then the reason why they would be chayav misal pi halacha is because they're violating one of the sheva mitzvahs b'nei Noach, namely ritzicha, and a goy who murders is chayav misa, not under dinei Yisrael, but under dinei b'nei Noach. Now, the reason why I say that's important is that dinei b'nei Noach, you don't need all of the procedures that you need for Yisrael. A Yisrael who murders is also chayav misa. But you need, number one, hasra, you need warning. Number two, you need two edim. Number three, you need a Sanhedrin of 23 people with smicha, which we don't have. And number four, you actually need a Beis HaMikdash. So, in a sense, if the state of Israel were to impose capital punishment on a Jewish murderer, al pi halacha, it's very unclear that they would be allowed to do it. On the other hand, when they're imposing a death sentence on a non-Jewish murderer, like a terrorist, so one could argue under dinei b'nei Noach, you don't need edim, even an ed echad is good. You don't need smuchim. Because a non-Jewish court could judge them. A Jewish court can do it too. A Jewish court has the authority to dan under dinei b'nei Noach, just like a non-Jewish court, etc. So it would stand to reason, therefore, that there is no halachic impediment on the imposition of capital punishment on a non-Jewish terrorist. In fact, it's interesting, one of the hard questions you have is, well, under Sheva Mitzvahs V'nei Noach, any violation is a chiyuv misa, including theft. So should we pass a law that if an Arab steals, you know, he gets executed? That would be a very, very difficult thing to get by. And I'll give you a little answer to that in a moment. But therefore, if you're asking al-pi halacha, is it okay? It is okay. Now, what is the concern? Well, what if chas v'shalom, there would be a Jewish terrorist? Would we be allowed to put him to death? Again, a very good case could be made that we wouldn't be allowed to, but I can also give you a makor that we could, because the Rambam writes that there's something called mishpat hamelech, that even when you don't have a Sanhedrin, if there's a breakdown of law and order, the melech is allowed to execute a person without hasra. And one could argue that a court of the state of Israel could function under mishpat hamelech, so that would be shaykh. I don't know, that would be a hard shayla actually, but that would be yitochen and the like. So here's the question. I've heard it said, in addition to what you said, that one of the reasons why we don't want to execute terrorists is, although I can't say I understand this, it may increase anti-Semitism in the world. You know, Tucker Carlson will talk about our inhumane treatment of terrorists, you know, and the like. Yeah. So here's the question. Here's my question. If al pi dinei b'nei Noach, this person is chayav misa, are we allowed to use political and social concerns not to carry out the din misa? But pashtus, you got to follow the din, unless it's pikuach nefesh, unless somebody says, I'm going to blow up New York City if you execute this terrorist. Okay, so pikuach nefesh, we wouldn't do it. But if it's not a pikuach nefesh, just like a long-term anti-Semitic problem. On the other hand, I think I've mentioned this over the years, there is a very interesting sheet in some achreinim, and I really, really wish Rishainim would say it, that when the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that for violating dinei b'nei Noach, there's a chiyuv misa, these achrayinim learn, it doesn't mean they have to kill the guy. It means the Torah allows the society to even impose capital punishment, but they could decide to do less, and that would be the heter for jail for theft instead of death penalty. That's a beautiful logical chiddush. I actually love it. Problem is that I'm not aware of any makar in Rishayim that learns that way. All right, but some achrayim do say such a svara. So if you go with the svara that even under the dinei b'nei Noach, capital punishment is not mandatory, it's just a reshus that we have under dinei b'nei Noach, then it would be tachin to look at political and social factors, not to carry it out. But l'maisa, I think it's Well, okay, I mean, in my opinion, it's not important. I mean, I see very little justification not to give capital punishment to a terrorist. I mean, Avada, B'Shas Maisa, the guy was a Redef. So B'Shas Maisa, he for sure could have gotten killed beforehand. So, you know, the world does not need people like that. But okay, but as I say, but I think there is a, based on these Achrayim, there would be a heter not to impose it. Yeah. Is it a good thing to go to the mikveh before Shabbos? It is a good thing. It's not a chiyuv. Now, remember, for men going to the mikveh was required if you want to go to the makom hamikdash, etc., assuming you didn't have tumas meis, which all of us have. But the idea of going to the mikveh erev Shabbos is brought down in Sifrei Kabbalah and in Sifrei Chassidus as a way of getting the extra neshama of Shabbos, that the waters of the mikveh have a certain kedusha, and you are being reborn. It's like you're going back to the rechem, you're going back to the womb, and you're being reborn. So there would be an inyan of doing it, but it's not a chiyuv, and you have to balance it with all the other chiyuvim that you would have erev Shabbos. Yeah,
I don't know who says it, but that there's a malach standing over every blade of grass that hits it and tells it to grow, and I'm wondering why does a malach need to hit it? And similarly, we have, like, in Bereishis, that the food did not listen to the Hashem, and how is that possible?
Yeah, the statement that over every blade of grass there is a malach that hits it and says grow is actually a Gemara. It's mamish in the Gemara itself, such a thing. It's a beautiful thought. This takes actually Hashgacha Pratis much further than the Rambam. Right, the Rambam says, even for Jews, you don't always have Hashgacha Pratis. The Gemara seems to suggest there's Hashgacha Pratis even on a blade of grass, which is actually one of the Rayas the Baal Shem Tov frames, that there's Hashgacha Pratis on every single thing. Among Hasidim, if you pull off a leaf from a tree, there's a Taina. You know, don't, you know, you're just pulling things off. There's a Hashgacha for that leaf to be there. Why does it hit it? That's a good question. I think it's maybe indicating, since it's a remez, you know, Adam eats asada, a person is like a tree. So it's kind of indicating that, you know, sometimes you teach with a carrot encouragement, and sometimes you got to give discipline. So it's kind of using the mashal to kind of say the Adam, that's the eats asada, sometimes needs to be hit. I don't mean physically hit, but, you know, a discipline and the like. The issue of the tree rebelling is a real big problem. Right, you know what we're referring to. That in the beginning of the Torah, Hashem originally intended for the wood to taste just like the fruit. The wood, the apple wood, would taste like the apple, but the tree was mashana from Hashem's ratzon, so it has the apple and the wood tastes like wood. The wood does not taste like an apple. So the pella, right? This is a question every year, every single year. Everybody has this question. Trees are not balei bechira. If they're not balei bechira, then how can they deviate? Hashem says wood and fruit should be the same taste, and the tree rebels? What do you mean rebels? So I'll give you two pshatim. Both of them mean we don't take the word rebellion literally. According to one interpretation, the trees, let's say, were created by malachim. God designated the malach to go and create the tree. Right, now, a malach doesn't have bechira, but a malach can apparently misunderstand. So what it means is Hashem intended something, the malach misunderstood the shlichus and did it wrong. So that's one way of understanding it. So it's called rebellion in the sense of misunderstanding. Yeah, that's a chiddush in and of itself. The other explanation the Maharal gives is, again, it's figurative and metaphorical. It's just basically saying that the nature of physical bria never approaches the perfection of that bria as it exists in Hashem's seichel. Meaning in Hashem's seichel there is perfection, but as it gets more and more physical, going through many, 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 many stages, imperfections are introduced because the nature of Gashmias, the nature of physicality, is that it is removed from the pure Ruchnias of Hashem, And as a result, there will be kilkulim and defects and deficiencies. So this is one example of a deviation that is inherent in the physicality of the universe. So it's not a conscious rebellion. It's the nature that the physical world is in itself a rebellion against Hashem. I mean, it cannot reproduce the shlemus of the Bore. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I think one of the, from what I understood, one of the people who, the person who fell off or jumped off the crane was a victim of bullying. And
On the crane? I'm sorry, are you talking about at the demonstration or some other?
Yeah, at the demonstration. Yeah.
Maybe I don't have the story. He jumped off or he fell? That was an accident.
They said after that he jumped off, unfortunately. They said that he...
So it was mamash a suicide?
He committed suicide.
Yeah.
They said that he left a note.
Aye.
That he was going to do so. And from what I understood was that he described how you throughout his entire life, he was a victim of being bullied. His entire life, and in the counseling field, and the psychologist, and I even saw Rabbanim even talking about it. There's been a lot of awareness now about bullying and discussing about things that sort. And the thing that I was thinking of is that, you know, I feel like to some extent, you know, I think it's almost inevitable. Meaning that in the sense that like kids don't even necessarily, especially at a very young age, don't necessarily always have intent to, you know, when they're like calling somebody or whatever it is, they don't have an intent to always necessarily, you know, really cause themselves harm. But unfortunately, these things leave a lot of deep like wounds for a lot of. So the question is like, you know, is it really possible to really stop this phenomenon? Or what we are just
well. No, this is really, really tragic. I didn't know that. I thought it was an accident. He was watching it and lost his balance. But okay. Bullying, mamish, dinei nefashos mamish. You see stories in the non-Jewish world also, more so, of bullying teenage kids committing suicide because of bullying. It's a very, very serious thing. You know, I look back at my own life, and there were times as a kid. I mean, I you see the way it is. For some reason, leaders of classes, they decide to pick on somebody. And then you just become part of an army. It becomes just like a fun thing to do. And I'm thinking, like, why did I get involved in some of those meisim? By the way, sometimes I was the object of the meisim too. You know, I had it both ways. I was a bully and a bullied at different times. You know, so I had both types of experiences going on. And it's a real, real chaval. And the truth of the matter is, you're right. It's not necessarily a malicious intent. I mean, I'm looking back at myself. I didn't, you know, want to hurt the person. But it was our game. It was our thing. And you get caught up in peer pressure. You get caught up in everybody's doing it, you know, et cetera. And you don't even realize how the other person feels. You think like the other person is also part of the game also. And sometimes they do take it that way. No, so it's not so bad, but other times, God forbid, it can have those great repercussions. So I think there's a tremendous achrayus on parents and a tremendous achrayus on mechanchim to kind of talk about this. You know, I know sometimes parents have the attitude, hey, you got to be, you know, the kid should be tough enough to take it. You can't. I think Lemaisa, maybe that's also nichlal in his katnu hadairus. But you see, Chazal say, even things that we regard, and the Rambam brings it, halacha and hilchos teshuva, things that we regard as no big deal. The Rambam says, if you give somebody a nickname, hamachane shem lechaveira, you call him shorty, you call him fatty, whatever it would be. It says, ein lo chelek liolam haba. I'm assuming if that hurts him. I mean, assuming if he doesn't mind, it's probably okay. But even just calling somebody a name. So, I don't know. I mean, it's like all yetzer haras, but I think the problem is that mechanchim ignored it. Parents ignored it. They just didn't make it an issue, so it didn't register in people's consciousness. So unfortunately, these maisim happen, and we have to take musr, we have to take teichicha from it.
Is there a way to really stop it?
Listen, you can't stop it. I mean, you can't stop gun violence. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can't stop. but you can reduce it. And also, I think maybe you have to look at it from the other side as well. How do you prepare your kids to take it? In other words, on one hand, I teach my kid not to do it, but then I also have to teach my kid what to do when you're a victim of it. Do you fight back? Do you insult back? That's not a Tyrannical way. So I literally got this question today. Somebody wrote me that someone was bullying their five-year-old. Like, what is the five-year-old? What should we tell the five-year-old to do? And I thought the five-year-old should memorize. I mean, you're not going to give the five-year-old the whole shiur on this, but have one line that he should say. He says, Hashem doesn't like people who hurt other people, and I want Hashem to like me. And, you know, I think that may be a shtickel tochicha that maybe may rub off on the people that are just one sentence, not more than that. And it gives the kid a sense that Hashem loves him, and maybe hopefully that'll help him, but it's a very, very hard situation. Yeah, Ben.
There are people like the Yanuka that are known to do all sorts of life, and then people come to them for Yeshua. So what should our Mahalach be towards that, and does it go against Ham and Tia?
Go against what?
Against Ham and Tia.
I didn't get the last word.
Well,
what?
The classic of Tam and Tia.
Tam and Tia. Yeah. Yeah. So a little bit of word about the Yanuka. You know, I'm naturally a very, very, very cynical person about all of these inyanim. I don't pay attention to it. Basically, with apologies to Svardim, I said it's basically crazy Svardim that jump on every type of thing. But I will tell you, the Yanuka is a very, very chashuv a person. He's a great tzaddik, and what is especially nice is he is a very, very humble person. He is an anaf. He is not at all a balgaiva, and that is why he's become very, very private. You may recall 2 years ago, it's like, again, the Svardim, the crazy Svardim. I'm not saying all Svardim, I mean the crazy Svardim were like every, you know, movement. You know, the Yanuka's doing this, no, you know. Yanuka's eating Cheerios, whatever it is. Everything was a YouTube video. But now, if you notice, the Yanuka is very, very bitsina, and I can imagine that he said that, stop, you know. If I want to be an Eved Hashem, I can't just, everything has to be public. So, and I was zochet to meet him. I was at a bris with him. So he is a very fine person, and I believe that as a tzaddik, his brachos can have a koach. A very, very great person. In fact, I was so amazed. Rav Baruch Mordechai Yizrachi, Zichrono Livracha, who was not a chassid and not a mekubel, he was a great Litvasher Rosh Yeshiva. He used to show up at the, I couldn't believe it, frankly, because you had the, again, I apologize for keep on saying crazy Svardim, but I'm just using it as, you know, because you had the crazy Svardim, and then you had Rav Baruch Mordechai Yizrachi there. Like, what is he doing there? This is not his island. So the fact that he went, I think, shows quite a lot. But the only thing is, it depends what you're doing, meaning to say, go to him for a bracha. Go to him to ask him to daven. Go to him for advice in life, of course. But, you know, don't use him for nevuas. Don't use him for other things. That would be a violation of tamim tia, to ask him to tell her, when will I have a shidduch, you know, or whatever. So, like all great tzaddikim, you go to him like a great tzaddik, but don't look at him as an astrology thing that will tell you, you know, what's going to happen to you tomorrow and the like. But again, I say I am machshuv him as a person. He is someone that's worthy of giving brachas. Yeah?
Different kinds of toma, like, have, let's say, like, for tamei meis, like, there's a reason different stuff create, like, toma on people. And, like, touching a dead body, it's because, like, the loss of life, you're in some, I don't know, for some reason causes people to be tamei. And what's, like, the reasoning behind if you touch a bug, it's tamei, or you become tamei?
You actually don't. Again, let me explain something. Tuma is when you're connected to death. Connecting to death, you know, renders you in a state of impurity from God. In effect, it's a re-expulsion from the Garden of Eden, so to speak, which brought death into the world. And that is why the greater the life force, the greater the tuma when that life force leaves. That is why touching a dead human is much more chamor than touching a dead animal. Touching a dead human, you are tamei for 7 days, and you need the ashes of para aduma. Touching a dead animal, you're only tamei for 1 day. A dead animal that wasn't shechted, meaning if it was shechted, if you eat a hamburger, you're not tamei to kosher hamburger. But if it was a nevela that wasn't shechted, you're tamei for 1 day, and all you do is go to the mikveh, and you don't have to be sprinkled with para aduma. But even then, so for example, dead plants don't convey tumah. Dead insects don't convey tumah. It has to be a bit of a higher form of life.
But if you just touch a target, it doesn't convey tumah?
No, it does not.
No. Is there any kind of thing surrounding an insect that, or like, I think it's a touch of tumah, rather creepy.
Well, what? Yeah, but the creepy thing is talking about things like mice, rats. It's talking about there is a tumah of sherets, but a sheret is not an insect. A sheret is a mouse or rats, you know, small mammalian creatures that crawl on all fours. But it is not referring to insects.
That's only if it's dead, or that's also if it's
alive? Only if it's dead. If it's alive, it does not convey tumah. No animal conveys tumah when it is alive.
And every animal conveys tumah when it's dead.
Well, I mean, insects are animals, but whatever. Higher order animals, mammals, amphibians, reptiles, will convey tumah when they're dead, but not when not when a kosher animal is shechted. It does not convey tumah. But insects do not convey tumah. They're treif, of course. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing.
Even a live pig?
Yeah, a live pig does not convey tumah, for sure. A dead pig conveys the same tumah as a dead cow that wasn't shechted. It's tumas nevela, that's it. Yeah.
Also, I've heard explained a bit that there's like a difference in what's the reasoning behind tumah. Like, it's like not reasoning, but like, let's say there's a lacha by tumah that you can't go to the Beis HaMikdash. So is it just like a practical scenario, or is it like a reality that like there's some spiritual reality?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and that is a big machlokas. Some say there's no such thing as tumah. All that means is it is a condition that generates certain laws, meaning if I do X, Y, and Z, I touch a corpse, I'm not allowed to go to the Beis HaMikdash, I'm not allowed to eat korbanos, etc. So tumah is nothing more than the laws that attach to a given situation. Meaning there's nothing that's in you, there's nothing that's happening to you, there's nothing that is in your neshama in any way. It's just a law of a bunch of laws. There are laws. When you're tamei, you can't do X, Y, and Z. But others learn not that way. Others learn that the laws themselves are generated from the spiritual state, that tumah is like a poison or a miasma of the soul that separates you from God. See, the reason why this is an important question is there any inyan to try to make myself tahor if I'm not planning on going to the Beis HaMikdash? I'm not going to the Beis HaMikdash, so I'm tamei. Okay. If tumah is simply restrictions, then if those are not relevant to you, you got no problem. But if I learn there's some spiritual problem within me because of tumah, then there's a mitzvah to correct it. Now, unfortunately, that is bad news for us, because all of us are considered to be tamei bizman hazeh, because if we've ever been into a cemetery, we contracted tumas meis, and we cannot get out of it without para aduma. Now, if you looked at tumah as simply halachos of not entering the mikdash, right, so I don't go to the mikdash, but my avodas Hashem when I'm here is just as good. But if you look at it the other way, that actually means there's a pagam in our avodas Hashem because of tumah that unfortunately we're not yet able to fully correct. So what you're saying is a machlokas.
Is one of them that you trust in life? Do you say the sister is the one that...
I'm not aware if there's a psak. I'll look into it a little more. I'm not aware of a psak halach on this theoretical question. Yeah?
When it comes to the Shulchan Aruch bringing down halacha, where maybe it's the Rosh and the Rambam, it goes like the Rosh, much less great. I don't understand how I'm bound by that. Why can't I say, oh, the Rambam's in this Torah, or later Hoskin wrote the Rambam's Torah, like, why am I bound to the Shulchan Aruch? Why is that?
Yeah, so the interesting question is, the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, wrote a book based on the Beis Yosef, his much larger Sefer on the Torah, where Rav Yosef Karo gives us Piskei Halacha based on Rishayim. Rishayim debate different things, and Rav Yosef Karo gave us a psak, and the Ramah sometimes gives us a different psak. And the question becomes, since everything is based on Rishayim, and Rav Yosef Karo followed a famous 2 out of 3 rule of all of the Rishayim. There are many Rishayim, but he picked 3 Rishayim that he considered to be the dominant ones, the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rush. And he then mechanically said, I'll go with 2 out of 3 to be Machriya the Halacha. Now, he doesn't always follow that rule. I mean, he himself doesn't always follow, but you know, most of the time he does. In a way, that's an unfair stacking of the deck, because the Rif and the Rambam are almost always the same, and it's the Rush that's the odd man out. So essentially, he delegitimated the Rush as a final halacha, and the Ramah, who's cholek, is usually following the Rush. That's kufa, the way it works. But the question becomes, okay, so why does that bind me? I mean, this is based on Rishayim anyway. So if I think the Rambam is right or the Rush is right, so I'm following the Rush, I'm following the Rambam. Why am I mechuyav bedafka to follow the Shulchan Aruch? So the emes is, that when the Shulchan Aruch was first written, there were kama v'kama gedalim that said, who says we got to follow this at all? Maharal of Prague was actually against the Shulchan Aruch. He says, okay, Rav Yosef Karo was a very, very great man, but I mean, he can't tell me what the halacha is. I go back to the Rishayim and Amachriya. If I think the Rambam is right, or the whatever it is, I'll go with that. The Temonim, not all Temonim, but there's a group of Temonim to this day that goes like the Rambam and not the Shulchan Aruch, even though, as they say, Shulchan Aruch often follows the Rambam. So, but what happened basically is that there is no intrinsic bi'etzem reason that the Shulchan Aruch is binding, but it became a kubal. Klal Yisrael was makabalit, so now it becomes a mina kabbalah. The emes is, the Vilna Gaon famously says that any Talmud Chacham that's higiyah lahayra. Now this is a loaded definition. Any Talmud Chacham who has truly reached the level of being able to paskin by looking at a sugya is not mechuyev to follow the Shulchan Aruch. And people mistakenly think the Vilna Gaon is only talking about himself. No, he's not. He's not just saying this is what he does. If it's just what he does, all right. So he was different, obviously, than anybody else. But he was laying down a rule for anybody. Now, the question always is, you know, are you higiyah lahayra? Am I, you know, most of us, include myself, I would not put in that particular category. But according to that, there's no intrinsic chiyuv, but it became the minhag that was makobo in Klal Yisrael. Yeah?
You say you can reach a higher level of learning in Eretz Yisrael, so you think that the Yerushalmi would be higher than the Bavli.
Yeah.
Why do we go like the Bavli and all these shuls are going to study the Bavli?
Right, so the question is if the heir of Eretz Yisrael gives a person greater chachma, so and we have a Talmud that was written in Eretz Yisrael, the Talmud Yerushalmi, why is the halacha, number one, like the Bavli, keneged the Yerushalmi, and number two, our learning, Be'ikr is Talmud Bavli, Talmud Yerushalmi is not learned bekvias in the yeshiva, shouldn't the Talmud Yerushalmi be on a higher level, so to speak? It is a very, very good question. So one answer is that since the Yerushalmi is earlier than the Bavli, so when they were Masadr the Bavli, they saw the Yerushalmi. So therefore, whatever they didn't accept was a hachra, right? It's a halacha kibasrai. You look at the later generation. Another is a bit more mystical, and it could very well be that the very kedusha of the Yerushalmi means we're less capable of understanding it. Meaning, we need the halacha presented on a lower level. Rav Cook points out this observation. I'm going to end here because I'm sorry I'm keeping you so late, but I'll just end with this. That is, the Shakla Vitarya in the Yerushalmi is much shorter and abbreviated than the Shaklavatari in the Bavli. Yerushalmi, you have a Mishnah, Kasha, answer, that's it, next Mishnah. Bavli may go on and on and on. Rav Kook says that because the Yerushalmi was written at a higher level of Ruach HaKodesh, it doesn't spell out. It'll go from A to Z and not spell out the B, C, D, E, F. And that's why Yerushalmi is difficult. The Bavli, because of the Gullus, spells everything out. And if you think about Shaklavatarya, a lot of Shaklavatarya is a process of elimination, meaning you're getting to MS by eliminating the Sheker. You see what I mean? In other words, you say, well, maybe it's this. No, it can't be this because of this. Maybe it's this. In the Yerushalmi, it just goes to the bottom line right away. So Rav Kook says, Bedafka in the Gullus, we need that process of elimination because we don't see the MS with clarity. So for Keret, it actually is the higher Madrega of the Yerushalmi that we can't use it for Halacha Psuka. That's what Rav Kook says. Now, the other thing is, you know, Baruch Hashem, there's now an art scroll on Yerushalmi. I don't know if they finished it yet. And Bederech Klal, but, you know, art scroll Bavli exponentially expanded Daf Yomi. I mean, the number of people who joined Daf Yomi because of art scroll, I mean, they, you know, people like to knock art scroll, and I've been guilty of that sometimes myself. But the Harbatzas Torah that they've generated with the Shas is amazing. And Bezrat Hashem, maybe the Yerushalmi will be the same. Maybe not the same, but at least a lot more people will learn Yerushalmi based on the art scroll. So Be'ezras Hashem, all of us should be Zaycha to finish the Bavli many times and to finish the Yerushalmi many times as well. You know, Rav Asher Weiss has an interesting Seder. I never heard anyone who does this. He alternates. Every year, one year he'll do Bavli, so he's learning all of Shas in one year, and the next year he'll do Yerushalmi. He alternates Bavli and Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi, of course, is much shorter, but still. To do Shas Bavli in one year, that's at least 7 blot a day. And Yerushalmi, you can do it in one year with 3 blot a day. But still, that's a big accomplishment. So something to aspire to, something to think about. Maybe I could fit that in. Okay. All right, be well. Take care.
Thank you for listening to this awesome Erech production. To find out more and to partner in our mission, please visit ohr.edu.